Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Take Two Radio. This is Pam, your host, and tonight I have with me my lovely co-host, Dawn. How are you doing, Dawn?
I'm great. I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Let me see if we have our guest on the line. Area code 609, who's calling, please?
Hello.
Hello, this is Pam. Is this Eric?
This is Eric Braden.
Oh, great, great. I'm so happy. We were worried about you. We're glad you're okay.
I am very, very sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
I apologize profusely. My wife and I went to a movie, and I didn't realize how the time had passed.
Yeah.
And suddenly it dawned on me. I said, oh, shit.
It's okay.
Perfectly okay.
We're very delighted to have you with us tonight. So thank you for
Thank you very much. And again, my profuse apologies. I just don't do that.
Oh, that's okay.
There you are. Really, don't
worry about it.
I saw a wonderful film called Searching for
Sugarman.
Have you seen that film?
Searching for Sugarman?
Yeah. Have you seen it?
No. What is that about?
Fantastic film. It's a semi-documentary. It's just a fantastic film. About one of America's great musicians, a guy called Rodriguez, who lives on the streets in Detroit and was undiscovered for all those years, for decades, and didn't realize that he was a huge success in South Africa.
Didn't I tell you to shut up?
And somehow they tracked him down. It's the story about all that. It's just a very heartwarming story.
That sounds good. That sounds really good. Well, I did have a big opening for you, so if you bear with me.
Yes. So you two are where? You're in separate places.
Yes, I'm in Chicago, and Dawn is in North Carolina.
Uh-huh. Okay, cool.
Okay. So I was going to say, tonight we welcome film, television icon, Emmy Award winner, People's Choice Award winning actor, and political activist, Eric Braden, who has also starred as one of the most popular characters in daytime history, Victor Newman, for over 32 years on the number one rated soap, The Young and the Restless.
Well done.
Did you like that one?
That's cool.
Hello and welcome.
And all true.
I said we can go on for hours with all the things that you've done in your life, but I wanted to ask you about, you have so many awards and medals that you've gotten throughout the years, just to name a few of them for our listeners. In 1958, the German Youth Team Championship in discus, javelin, and shot put.
You got that right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. In 1972-73, the U.S. Championship for the Maccabees for soccer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
In 1995, you received the highest honor from the Italian television and Italian television in Italy from Prime Minister, you're going to have to help me.
Berlusconi.
Thank you.
Berlusconi, right.
Thank you. In 1998, you received the People's Choice Award as a favorite actor in daytime drama series for your role as Victor Newman on The Young and the Restless.
Mm-hmm.
2007, you got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And you were nominated for 7 Emmy Awards and in 1998 received the Emmy Award as Outstanding Actor in Daytime Drama Series.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one that I'm going to mention is you've received twice the Federal Media of Honor by President of Germany for your contribution to the German-American relations. And with that, my question is, what award or medal means the most to you and why?
My God, you got it all correct. And I would say the National Championship and Youth Championship in Germany, 58. Discus, javelin, and shot put. Then I would say the U.S. Soccer Championship in 1973. That's in sports, two very important milestones for me. And then I would say People's Choice Award meant a lot to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame meant also a great deal to me. So I cannot tell you in what order, depends on what time of my life, but they all meant something to me.
They're all very important. a great recognition for you.
Right.
Discus, javelin, and shot put.
Mm-hmm.
How did you train for that?
Well, you must remember I grew up in post-war Germany where we had, you know, very little. So instead of weights, we did endless push-ups and chin-ups and push-ups and things to make you stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have weights then. That came in later. And a lot of practice, three times a week, and had to take a bicycle to ride to a train station and take the train to ride into town. The whole thing took 1.5 hours, and then go to practice, and for 1 hour, 2 hours, and then do the whole trip back.
Oh, wow.
And, so it those were rough times. And when I then came to America in 1959 and had a scholarship at the University of Montana in Missoula, and they showed me the training rooms and the facilities, I absolutely was blown away. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe the luxury in which American athletes trained.
Right, right.
I mean, weights and ice baths and whirlpools and I mean, just incredible. And then later on, I found out that you have that almost in every American high school.
Yeah.
So it's mm-hmm. paradise. I wish I'd grown up here.
Yeah, it
there
definitely makes you appreciate it.
My God, I tell you. So I think American athletes have the facilities of what maybe the very top pros in other countries may have. But here it's accessible in high school.
Wow. Well, you definitely learned how to keep in shape from all of that.
Yeah, it taught me a great amount of discipline, and it taught me to, I think without sports, who knows, it would have been difficult, I think, to relax and to it just brings me down, and I feel wonderful afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the amount of endorphins that flood your brain and your body, it all feels damn good, you know?
Yeah.
I cannot imagine life without working out. I can't.
Right.
Yeah.
Even when I'm alone somewhere and have no access to gyms or whatever, I just shadow box in whatever room.
Oh.
And I'll take the suitcases and do, you know, bicep curls or push-ups or whatever it is. I just need to work out
mm-hmm.
at least once a day. Yeah.
Well, I think
when I traveled with my wife, I used
me.
To put her. When I traveled with my wife, I used to put her in the old days. Used to put her on my shoulders, and I would walk with her, or I would do squats with her on my back.
Oh,
yeah.
Did she have fun?
Looked rather strange. Yes, I think she had fun. Must have looked rather strange to onlookers, but I didn't give a damn. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now we know that all these years that you've hit that punching bag on Y&R, that you really can hit that punching bag. You
well,
know,
anyone who knows anything about it will recognize that. And anyone who knows
yes.
anything about it will also recognize that some others are, you know, embarrassingly, well, let's not talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah, amateur man, oopsie.
Yeah, well, you've done so many things along sports lines, and, you know, if you had not pursued acting, do you think you would have played sports professionally as your chosen career?
That's a very good question, and I grew up at a time when, had I grown up in America, I think I would have loved to have played football. I love that game. But having grown up where I grew up and at a time where that wasn't really, you know, to your advantage professionally. In other words, the kind of monies they pay now or for
mm-hmm.
the last 15 years is
mm-hmm.
just extraordinary. I mean, when you think that you can retire after about 5 or 6 years of, if you're at the top of your game.
Right.
Be it even in tennis, be it in boxing, be it in football, be it in baseball, basketball, soccer. I mean, that didn't exist. So it really was not a long-term thing to aim for, because you couldn't sustain making a living. But mm-hmm. nowadays they make so much in such short time that if they're smart, they're set for life, you know?
Right.
That's
yeah.
true. And I understand that along sports lines that you are a huge Lakers fan.
Yes.
And have you been catching, I know this, you know, we're early in the season, but have you been catching any of the games so far?
Yes. Right. And but I did not, in fact, I'm going to watch it later. They're playing tonight under the new coach, I think, and I'm very curious. Obviously, we've all been upset by the fact that Phil Jackson didn't come back. Why? Because he is obviously one of the most successful coaches in the history of basketball.
Oh, no doubt about it.
Yeah. So, but I guess one should give this fellow a chance. And, you know, it's difficult to, unless you talk to someone like Kobe or those personally, you don't really know what went on, you know?
Right.
And you don't really know if the offer to Phil Jackson was honest or not. Who knows? And who knows what kind of bad blood exists within that family.
Yeah.
You know, Phil Jackson is obviously an icon and is a 6'7", 6'8". And who knows how tall the son is of the owner. Probably much smaller. And
right.
He is this phenomenally successful coach with a very sort of quiet and authoritative demeanor. And I'm sure that the younger son didn't feel too comfortable around that. You know, big of a man in every respect.
Right.
Yeah.
Sometimes it could be intimidating.
So I think there's some psychological aspects to this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, most definitely. Now I understand that you like to travel.
That I like to travel.
Yes, and that you have been a lot of different places, and in all your travels, do you have a favorite place?
Oh boy. Well, to be very honest with you, and this may sound terribly boring, for years, all I wanted to do is go back to where I came from in Germany, to the village, to visit that. Not to live, but to visit it. And it just, you know, when you leave at a young age and you're emotionally tied to a place, you forever, in your mind, you think about that place.
Yeah.
And so over the years, I'd go back every 2 or 3 years, but only for about, 3 weeks at most. Never had the time to really spend any longer. So that is slowly diminishing because all my old friends have either moved away, or some of the even older ones on whose farms I used to work have passed. So there is really almost nothing left. There's a whole new generation there that I don't really know. They know me, but I don't know them.
Mm-hmm.
What I used to enjoy is go there and get on my bicycle or running suit and then, you know, visit the farms and sit and bullshit with the farmers that I'd worked for. And I just enjoyed all that enormously. And then every so often we'd all meet in the local inn and, reminisce about my dad and family and my youth. And then I had a very close friend who was on the German Olympic team and who was the top javelin thrower and one of the best in the world for a while. And he passed. He was about 15 years older than I am. And I used to always go over there. He and his wife would make coffee and cake in the afternoons. It's a German tradition. We would sit and we'd talk and reminisce, and then we'd go out. He had a ring in the back, and his wife would take a tape measure, and we would do shot put, you know. And then I used to just enjoy taking my bicycle and with one of my brothers or alone, and just ride through the countryside, you know, and just remember things, reminisce. So that's slowly gone because my family is here. My son, my wife, and my grandchildren. And so slowly the roots you know, I'm being uprooted there, and I feel much more at home here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I can imagine. They say, you know, home is where the heart is. And for you, you know, you have home in two places in the world,
right.
Here and there. And I know it's got to be, you know, such a reminiscent time when you go back.
But I've learned to
native country.
I've learned to like a lot of places in America. And you're from North Carolina. I like that. It's a beautiful state. And I was there a few months ago in Bath. And what a beautiful place. And what nice people. And Raleigh-Durham, I remember, has a very good airport. Very clean, very nice. There are so many beautiful places in America, Mike, and I've been almost everywhere, you know. So it depends on, I remember being somewhere in Iowa on some public appearance, and then I usually like to sneak away from the hotel and then just run to the wheat fields, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
By myself, I love that. And Canada, I mean, Toronto, I've always enjoyed, I must say. And once in the middle of Canada and on the way to Lethbridge, and I told the limo driver to stop, and I just wanted to run by the side of the road to the prairie. And there's so many. New York is a fascinating city. I did a film in Texas. And we traveled all the way through from one end to the other, and we filmed near Brackettville, Texas, and that had its own charm. And it's a lot of places I like. Paris, I love Paris, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Love Paris and London, but the countryside in England is fantastic. But the countryside in America is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
My God, when you travel through it. South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, you know, areas in Ohio and Iowa and obviously Montana, Wyoming, I've been to all the Colorado, New Mexico, I've been everywhere. California, gorgeous places here. So it's a beautiful world and we must not screw it up.
Right, we should always take the time to smell the roses at the side of the road.
Oh my God Almighty, you're right about that. And that's why I'm just not... I love nothing more than taking long walks and take my son's dog for a walk and I'll sit by myself in the garage and turn on music and lift weights and our box, go down to the ghetto in Los Angeles, and used to go boxing there for years in the ghetto gyms, and that has a different atmosphere. Been very lucky to have been in so many places, you know, and
right.
Istanbul, for example, what a fascinating place. My God, what a fascinating place. What history. You know, you should make a habit of wherever you go, you should study the history of a famous place if you go to it. Even if you go to the South, think of the Civil War, think of all that. It's just extraordinary. American history is so damn interesting. And,
I couldn't agree more.
Oh, it is so interesting. You know, if you read David McCullough, wrote a book about John Adams, and then when you think that at that time it took him 4 weeks in the winter to ride from Boston to Philadelphia, for example, on horseback until he got
mm-hmm.
there. And when you think of these intellects who were the founding fathers of America, these bright, bright, extremely well-read people, John Adams, I think, was fluent in Latin, he had knowledge of Greek. It's a fascinating world, and the more you study about it, the more you learn about it, the more fascinating it is.
And it seems like, I'm sorry, the children don't appreciate that, because I know myself as a child going through history class, you didn't appreciate it, you just wanted to get through it.
Yeah, but
as
taught,
an adult,
it,
you learn to
often,
appreciate it.
It's often taught so badly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, the
so
curricula are very rigid, and it's often taught so badly. It's, I mean, when you go to Bath, North Carolina, for example, and you talk to some of the locals there, and they tell you about the history of it,
mm-hmm.
it's not fascinating. It's just unbelievably fascinating. You know,
and I think too, today in today's society, people, life is so fast paced that people don't take the time to really you know, learn about their local culture and learn about, you know, what is historical, even in their state, you know, and there is so much. I know in North Carolina it's just jam-packed full of, you know, historical places and just, I mean, you could go on forever learning about, you know, every inch of this country. There's just so much to know, and you could never know it all. It's kind of like going to Washington, D.C. and visiting the Smithsonian. You can never see it all in a day. It would take, you know, days upon days.
You're right.
And history is very much like that. You may think you've grasped everything in one sitting, but you go back to it again and you realize, oh, you catch something you didn't catch before. And it's so very enlightening. So it's probably the biggest educational piece that we have in our country, because history is what founded us. And
exactly. I think there's a tendency sometimes in America to sort of want to forget that. But, we all came, most Americans are descendants of people who came, as I came, by boat with a damn suitcase in my hand at the age of 18 and not knowing anyone, not knowing anything. I knew someone, but I, you know, beyond that, didn't know anything. And you just take a chance, and America is full of those people. That's why this country is so indomitable, I think, because it is full of people who have genetically had the guts to get up and uproot and, you know, go into a totally new adventure. You know nothing about it.
Right, and usually not have much to come here with.
Well, I had $50 in my pocket, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I know in
so you do all kinds of jobs
May of 2000, I'm sorry?
I said you do all kinds of jobs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To make a living from, my God, I did everything. From being a cowboy to moving furniture to washing dishes to parking cars and, you know. So, yep, and I'm grateful for it all.
Well, it helped you become the person that you are today.
Yep.
What I was saying, in May 2007, you received the Ellis Island Medal of Honor, which honors immigrants who come to America.
Right.
My question is, if you were in charge of immigration or could help with the laws, what would you do?
Well, I tell you, that is a very, very tough question for me to answer as an immigrant, because I came here and had to go through all the legal steps to get here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an issue. I usually am very liberal and very open-hearted, but I must say when it comes to that issue, I have difficulty accepting the fact that you know, people just come here illegally, and it makes me a little angry. On the other hand, I think we have always in this country been enormously hypocritical about the crossings of very poor people from Latin America,
mm-hmm.
who are desperately looking for a better life. We have been hypocritical in the sense that both sides, both Democrats and Republicans and Americans in general, and certainly big corporations and big businesses, because they have profited from that cheap labor.
Exactly.
And we knew it all along. We knew it all along. In other words, in L.A., for example, and this goes for a lot of cities in America, the entire gastronomy, in other words, all restaurants will go broke tomorrow if it weren't for the cheap labor. And, you know, I've known and I've played soccer against a lot of Mexicans and obviously go to restaurants where they work very hard. They're very hard-working people. Who have obviously contributed to this country.
Right.
Work in sweatshops downtown L.A. and for factories. And so it's I'm very ambivalent about it. We have, and I think that has never been really talked about, we in the 50s and 60s here in America were so afraid of another Cuban Revolution happening somewhere in South America that we sort of allowed that immigration to... You understand? We allowed them to come into America to absorb the revolutionary potential of Mexico and Salvador and Guatemala and all those countries, where the difference between rich and poor was so enormous, the chasm was so huge, that you really had a revolutionary potential in all those countries. And I think we knew that. And I think we open our borders, you know, with one wink. Do you understand? We sort of
right.
Turn
oh, yeah. Definitely.
And we have always been hypocritical because we are more concerned about avoiding another revolution next door, namely Mexico or Salvador or whatever. We were never honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, all big businesses profited enormously from cheap labor. And so I think most immigrants or illegal immigrants have paid their dues, I think.
Right.
So obviously one has to come to some accommodation. In other words, we couldn't possibly put them all on buses or planes and say, okay, you got to go across the border again.
Yeah.
On the other hand, for me as a legal immigrant who jumped through all kinds of hoops to come here legally, and it's almost impossible nowadays to come in here from Europe as an immigrant. They stop that more or less.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult, I think what we should do probably is what I assume Obama is trying to do, is to somehow accommodate those who have been here, who have had honest jobs, have worked hard, and most of them have, I know so, I see them work very hard,
mm-hmm.
And reward them for that somehow, but then close the damn thing.
Right.
I mean, you know, what,
right.
We can't close the border?
Yeah.
You must be kidding me. It's bullshit. Bullshit.
Yeah. But it is our border, after all.
Of course it is our border. Don't tell me that we can't close the damn thing.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
So.
It's very true.
We can come up with nuclear bombs and everything, so why can't we
well,
close the border?
Well, but the point is that you know, what it has done is it has allowed the status quo in Latin countries to continue. In other words, the inequities between rich and poor are so extraordinary that we have allowed that to sort of persist because the hopeless and the poor and the desperate always say, well, we can somehow sneak across the border and come to America.
Right.
And it has been to the benefit of America in many ways, no question about that. But when it comes to the legality of it, you know, it's I have ambivalent feelings about it, let me put it that way. Very ambivalent, because the Mexicans I've known or the Latins I've known who've come here have worked damn hard. So, I mean, really hard. And I see it. I see it all the time. And so I think they need to be somehow rewarded. And obviously kids who were born here who had nothing to do with the decision to come here, I think they should be part of the American society, period. So, but it's a difficult issue. But everyone in America, and I hope that neither Republicans nor Democrats have the audacity to say that one or the other is guilty. It's
right.
Nonsense. We all are. All
yeah,
of us here
true.
Are.
Very much
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
And having just held our presidential election, do you have a perspective on President Obama winning re-election?
Yes, I mean, you know, not. Holding back about my political views, and I like Obama. I voted for him, and that's as simple as it is. I think the man needs a chance for another 4 years to try to make certain things happen. I think when you have in the opposition and the person of Mitch McConnell, one of those nerds, one of those guys. A day or two after the assumption of power by President Obama, he says our task, our responsibility is to make sure that he is a one-term president. Well, that's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
mm-hmm.
you know, politics is about the art of compromise, and when you have a group of people that are diametrically opposed and rigidly opposed and will not give, will not come to any compromise, something is dreadfully wrong. And so that, unfortunately, came from what I find is the new version of the Republican Party. I remember in the old days, between Johnson and O'Neill, and then people reached across the aisle in Congress. And those days are long gone.
Yeah.
Now you have the Grover Norquist of this world who have people sign an oath, those who voted in by the Republican Party who go to Congress and say, no new taxes, period. You sign an oath. What they forget
mm-hmm.
is that Reagan raised taxes 10 or 11 times.
Right.
So did Bush Sr.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mathematically, it doesn't make any sense, does it?
No.
You have to raise taxes here and there in order to close the gap.
Mm-hmm.
It's anyway. I have difficulty with the issues raised by the Ryans of this world and the Tea Party people. I just have difficulty with that. I do. And I personally feel that a society, a government, has certain responsibilities when it comes to education. Look, it is always a question of balance. You don't want too much government control, but you don't want too little.
Right.
Now, people, think about this for one second. If you allow true free enterprise, unfettered by regulations, you would, because capitalism is essentially Darwinian, meaning the strongest will survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you follow that logic, that means that we would have been run in this country by a few families, the Rockefellers, the J.P. Morgans, the Carnegies of the turn of the century, 19th century powers, and they would have run this country. And they would have been monopolies. That means free enterprise would no longer exist. Then you had the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1900 that split up these kind of monopolies in order to make sure that not too much power was aggregated in fewer and fewer hands. So it seems antithetical, but in order to maintain a free enterprise, you need some government regulation. Period.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
You need somebody in
control. People don't understand. They don't think it all the way through.
Exactly.
That's true. Very true. Very true.
And what do you think would have happened without regulation? Just here in L.A., I came here in 1960. I remember, and I played sports here, and we trained four times a week, hard, sprint. I mean, there were nights where you couldn't breathe. The smog was so bad. So do you honestly think, I would always ask Republicans, do you honestly think that the car companies on their own would have seen to it that we have reduced emissions?
Never.
Are you kidding?
No.
Of course not.
Never.
It could only happen because it was demanded by the government.
Right.
Yep.
The question
That's
is
true.
Not too much government, but without it, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We would have destroyed this planet more than we already have a long time ago.
We would have spoiled and ruined all the rivers in America. You would not be able to live in certain cities because the smog was so bad. And I remember the 60s. It was terrible in some days. Absolutely unbearable. Couldn't breathe.
Wow. That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I'm
all about balance. Just balance it. Not too much of one, not too much of the other. Just balance it. Meaning reach across the aisles. Meaning let's shake hands, let's come to an agreement. Period.
And I hope they're able to do that. I mean, I really hope, Obama, he really had a lot of faith in him when he entered office initially. And, there was no way anybody could ever expect him to accomplish in 4 years, you know, and undo so much that had already been done before him. So, I'd like to be able to see, you know, Congress work with him a little bit more.
Oh, Don, I don't know. Who am I talking to? Was it Pam or Don?
No, it was Don.
Okay,
Don.
The point is, what more could he have done under the circumstances?
Right, exactly.
In other words, when everything is blocked, in other words, you have no chance for it to go through.
Mm-hmm.
What do people want?
I know.
His accomplishments, as far as I'm concerned, in foreign policy have been. Remarkable. I think he's basically, to be honest with you, he's a middle-of-the-road guy.
Yes.
He's kind of conservative, if you ask me. So his accomplishment in foreign policy, his going after terrorists, his going after Al-Qaeda, all over the place, has been exemplary.
Mm-hmm.
So and the mess that we are in the Middle East, in Iraq and Afghanistan, well, that was not started under his watch.
No,
I think
true,
he's, doing his damnedest to get us out of it as elegantly or inelegantly as we can. I have enormous respect for people who have, you know, spent time over there fighting. It must be very difficult. Bush Sr. knew not to remove Saddam Hussein from Iraq, because he knew if we remove him, then we allow the majority to step in. And the majority are Shiites, and they're natural allies of Iran. Is that what we wanted?
Yeah.
Bush Sr. and his advisors knew that is not what we want.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So very true. And, you know, and I know that, you know, you have been to Israel numerous times for various things, and you know, you're so revered by the Israelis and the Prime Minister, and you know, there is so much happening right now, just this week alone, and what are your thoughts on that?
My support, my deep support will always be for Israel, because if you have any kind of historic consciousness, then you, as a German, born German, you have to realize that Israel is the result of anti-Semitism, and specifically of the policies of the Nazis during the Second World War. Had it not been for the Holocaust, I don't think Israel would exist, certainly not in the form that it does now. In other words, the Holocaust, which happened, I, as a German, cannot but be in support of Israel. And is it a difficult situation in the Middle East? You bet. Do I understand what the Palestinians are griping about? You bet. It's very difficult. But will I support the desire of Jews to have a country of their own and to defend it? You bet. So it's again one of those very difficult situations. We must all work to somehow solve it. And do I agree with all the policies of the Israelis? Not necessarily always. Do I agree with the policies of the Palestinians in regard to Israel? No. Have they never heard of Martin Luther King? Have they never heard of Gandhi? You know, I asked that question sort of rhetorically 30, 40 years ago. I said, have you never heard of Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi? Have you never heard about peaceful demonstrations? And instead, it is this eye for an eye bullshit over there that goes for all sides over there.
Right.
That I've never understood.
It leads to
nothing.
Right.
I asked the question of Shimon Peres, who was then president of Israel, wonderfully wise man. I talked to him for about an hour, and I said, "Mr. President, I was born in a country that was responsible for two of the most cataclysmic wars mankind has ever seen. And one of our arch enemies was France, and now both Germany and France are the cornerstone of the European Union." I said, "So I'm an eternal optimist, but I think this might happen in the Middle East, that eventually you might create a common market here." And imagine that. The tourists would flock to this part of the world because it is historically so rich. So he took me to the window of his office, and he says, "Down there is where my friend Yitzhak Rabin was killed." And he was killed by one of those ultra-Orthodox characters and who didn't want any kind of attempt at reconciliation with the Palestinians, I guess. It's a conundrum, but I will always support Israel, and simply because, as a German, I feel that responsibility. Period. Out, gone.
Right.
So there you are.
I want to say thank you for that, and I'm sure many other people do in this world that have lived through both sides of it, and thank you for helping and caring.
It's a very, very difficult situation. My goodness. And right now in Syria, for example, that's a conundrum. You know, people forget, we all forget, how a lot of this started. It started already in the First World War, when the Western powers, meaning mostly France and England, divvied up the Middle East in the middle of the First World War, what's called the Sykes-Picot Treaty, when the two, the Brits and the French got together, and in 1915, the war had just begun, said, in case we win against the Turks, who were occupying a lot of the Middle East, and the Turks were allies of the Germans, in case we win the First World War, we'll divvy up the Middle East according to French and English interests. Mm-hmm. And that's what created Iraq. That's what created Syria. That's what created all those countries. They are artificial creations. We forget that.
Or they haven't paid attention to it.
No, we just forget that, you know. So, and then with Iran, when people say Iran, they're incapable of democracy, well, bullshit. In 1953, Iran had a democratically elected man called Mossadegh. And Mossadegh, we didn't want him there because it was too democratic, so the CIA and British intelligence got rid of him. We put in the Shah in order to make sure that we had unimpeded access to oil. Most people don't know that.
No.
Yeah.
So now we all say, that world is not capable of democracy. Well, we did everything in our power to kill it.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's
talk about YNR.
Okay. That's what we were going
to talk about, YNR.
I'm sorry that I got sidetracked here.
I love listening to you talk about different things. You're so interesting, and I love the stories you tell. You're just phenomenal. But yes, let's talk about YNR and Victor Newman. Oftentimes, I think people wonder, I know I have wondered this myself, do you ever see any parallels between you, Eric Braeden, and Victor Newman, the character?
I personally am not that vindictive. I personally am very concerned about my family, which Victor is, of course, as well, but in a slightly different way. Business means everything to him. I can't stand it if there's discord within my own family for very long. You know, I usually... We hug each other, and everything is cool again, and forgive each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very close to my son, very close to my grandchildren. Yes and no. I think what is similar is that I don't take any shit.
Right.
So it's that's similar. I learned to defend myself since I was 12 years old, and my father died then, and I've been on my own ever since. Earned every penny I've ever earned on my own. So, in other words, when the story Victor's life refers to his having been left in an orphanage,
right?
There's certain emotional things that I can, you know, reach into in order to envision what that must have been like, because it's when you see one of your parents die at that young age and you lose everything. We lost everything, and I grew up in poverty after that. You learn to take care, because there's no dad to take care of you. So you learn to you know, fight on your own. So obviously I had a lot of fights, and to the point where they wanted to throw me out of school. I'd knocked someone out in the shower, and I was 14, and the teacher came in and wanted to, you know, pressed me down, and I said, you want something too? And so they wanted to throw me out of school. And my mother came, and my mother, my God, when I think of what she went through, two world wars, whoa. And she went to the director of the school, and she said, sir, how do you think that I deal with four of these headstrong boys as a widow? And you tell me that you, as a man, cannot take care of this one boy and lead him in the right direction. And that made sense to the director, and I stayed. So, but childhood and adolescence and the teenage years were tough. mixed with very tough and not knowing sometimes where the next meal will come through, and
hello?
Yeah, so, anyway.
I thought we had lost you there for a minute.
In that regard, this life is somewhat similar.
Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes left, and we have some callers on the line. Would you like to take some calls?
You bet.
Okay. All right. We're going to take the first call will be from David. And hello, David. You are on with Eric Brady.
Hello, Eric.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, sir.
All right. Thank you. Where
are
you calling from?
I'm calling from Central New York.
Oh, yeah.
Just west of Albany.
I beg your pardon?
Just west of Albany.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I don't think I've ever been up there. I've been to New York, I mean, city Manhattan and all that, but never up there.
Mm.
Yes, David, what's your question?
Well, one, I just want to let you know I have so much respect for your craft and everything that you've done.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And my question is that when you were growing up, who were the positive influences on your life?
That's a very good question. Mostly athletes that I admired. And I must say, when I was about 13, 14, I grew up as a Protestant and obviously asked very searching questions after my father passed. And obviously you ask questions about life and death and the meaning of it all, and having had to go to certain religious classes and all that, I began to ask those questions, but no one could really answer them. But what impressed me then was enormously was the life of Albert Schweitzer. Albert Schweitzer was a German intellectual who went to Africa, and he was a doctor. And he ran a colony for lepers. And I thought that sort of, to me, was an inspiring example of what it meant to be a Christian. So I must say that was sort of an ideal. And I actually, at the age of 13, 14, sort of contemplated maybe joining Albert Schweitzer in Africa. And in other words, if there's something inspiring about the notion of Christ, it is precisely the notion of helping those who need help, of helping the poor, of forgiveness, of universal love. I mean, that, I think, is really the essence of most religions. And we just get sidetracked with all kinds of denominational bullshit. And so that, I must say, the figure of Albert Schweitzer was very inspiring to me. And then, of course, you know, I read a lot of stories about the American West and about cowboys and Indians. And we couldn't wait for, they had weekly sort of novels in the form of little thin paperbacks writing about stories about the American West. And always envisioned to be, you know, the leading character. And later on, when I was in Montana and was a cowboy, I realized that a lot of that romance goes right out of the rear end when you sit on the damn horse for 8 hours or whatever. So, but then one of my childhood heroes as an athlete was Perry O'Brien, the American shot putter. We used to, you know, when we did the shot put, we were the best team in Germany, and Germany was always a very good track and field power. We used to analyze the technique, and my idol was Perry O'Brien. And years later, I walk into a bar in L.A., and I'd done the Rat Patrol, the series about the Second World War. It was very popular in America for a while. And I remember walking into a bar that was just about to close, and I knew the manager. And he said, yeah, I'm going to throw out that bum that's sitting over there in a minute. And I looked and said, wait a minute. If that is who I think it is, you better not try that. I said, he'll throw you and the bar out at the same time. He'll lift the whole damn thing off its foundation. He said, what do you mean? I said, I think that's Barry O'Brien. That's an extraordinarily strong man. I said, that was my idol as a kid. I said, let me see. So I walked up, and he had had a few beers too many, I think. And I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, Mr. O'Brien, I'm sorry, I'm so-and-so, and you were my idol when I grew up. I studied you. He says, he looked at me, so bleary-eyed, and says, wait a minute, you're the guy from the Rat Patrol. And I said, but that's not the part. Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yeah, can you imagine?
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Eric, for speaking to me today.
And I admired that time. I admired Eisenhower. I was a big admirer of Eisenhower, I must say. He always impressed me as a very, first of all, as an extraordinary general, but then also as a very decent man. There's a basic decency in Eisenhower that I don't see in a lot of these new right-wingers.
Wow. Did you have any other questions, David?
No, I think he was very thorough.
Yeah.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Yep. Bye.
Okay, next up we have Travis. Travis, say hello to Eric.
Hello.
Hey, Travis, how are you?
Very well, yourself.
And where are you calling from?
I am calling you from Maine. I'm in the state of Maine.
From Maine, wow. You know, that is one state I have not been to.
Well, you need to.
Yeah, I heard it's beautiful. I have a number of friends who have been there, and it's absolutely beautiful, I heard.
Yeah, it's a great state. I lived in northern Maine pretty much all my life, and I finally got down to southern Maine this June. So I'm moving my way closer and closer, hopefully farther and farther away, just so I can see what's out there, you know what I mean?
Oh, rather man, the world is interesting.
The world
is interesting, yep.
Yeah, most definitely. First off, I've been listening to you for the last 40 minutes. I just want to say, wow. It was very, very, very educational, and it was just very informative, and I just really appreciate you being so open and sharing so much about your life and your thoughts and your mindset with us. I think that it was just a wow moment. It was really great to hear.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, very, very welcome. I just want to let you know, my grandparents, they're both passed away now. One passed away 2 years ago. The other one passed away about 5 years ago now. But they were huge Young and the Restless fans and huge fans of yours, as Eric Braden and, of course, Victor Newman.
Well,
and and they got me into Young and the Restless. So because of them, I was a huge fan. And my family now, we watch Young and the Restless, you know, for you, of course, and because of my grandparents, you know, to keep on the legacy of being a Young and the Restless fan.
That's so nice to hear. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
What do you do, David?
What do you do?
Travis?
Travis. What do you study?
Sorry. I graduated in May with my bachelor's in behavioral science, social work.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I got my 4 years degree. I moved downstate for, you know, more job opportunity, but right now I'm currently working at Rite Aid. Rite Aid, there's a pharmacy, and it's I know it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know what I'm talking about. Okay, I wasn't sure because some states don't have Rite Aid, so I wasn't sure which one.
No, they have it in California. Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so I'm training right now as a shift manager and hopefully assistant manager at some point.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty much what I have, you know, around me right now. There's not a lot of job opportunities for behavioral science.
Well, you sound very bright. So I'm sure that you'll be successful.
Yeah. That means a lot. I wanted to ask you a quick question, if you don't mind. I don't want to take all your time, but just have a question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally a random question. I'm a huge, you know, I love Young and the Restless, and I'm also a huge Days of Our Lives fan. I've been watching Days of Our Lives for about 18 years now.
Right.
You know, as well with Young and the Restless, kind of went hand in hand, you know.
Right.
If you were to go on Days of Our Lives, what family would you see yourself into?
To be honest with you, I cannot answer that honestly because I just don't. I don't know enough about that show.
Okay.
I have to tell you honestly, I don't watch it. I barely watch our show. Only when my wife makes me aware of certain scenes, then I'll watch it. I don't. I'm sorry. I don't watch.
Don't be sorry. No, not a problem at all.
So,
it was just a question. I was just, you know, I really wanted to call and just like chat, hear your voice, and you know,
right.
talk to you.
Right.
I thought it was just, you know, such a great opportunity. I mean, not many people can say they talk to Mr. Eric Braeden. You know, big huge fan, and I just you know, big supporter of yours, and I just want to thank you for, you know, being a part of our lives for so many years. And,
well,
I
really appreciate that. And let me tell you something. How old are you now?
I'm 27.
Well, whatever you do, just do it with pride, you know? Do it with enthusiasm. Whatever you do, it doesn't make a difference what the job is. Just always do it with pride. And
yes,
say,
sir.
I'm going to do the best I can. Because it's all jobs. I don't care what the jobs are. We obviously all contribute somehow. And it is satisfying if you know, if you can look yourself in the mirror and say, you know, I tried my hardest. And anyway, I appreciate your comments, Travis, and be cool, my man.
I will. Thank you so
right.
much, and it was
You're
a
welcome.
Pleasure talking to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
Same
you,
team.
Travis.
You're
Thank
very
you,
welcome.
Travis.
Thank you, Dawn. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Have a good
Bye-bye.
Night.
Okay. Next up, we have Angela, and she's calling in from Atlanta. Say hello, Angela.
Hi, Eric.
Hello, Angela.
It's an honor to speak with you. I've really enjoyed you as Victor Newman on Young and the Restless for a long time. But one of the things that I have enjoyed the most from you has been the oral history that you did on the Emmy Foundation website.
Oh, my God, you saw that. I'll be damned. Oh, yeah. Interesting. That's the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences or something, right?
Correct.
Is that what it is?
It's a multi-part, and it really covers, you really covered so much of your life, and it's very fascinating, and just, you know, I would say to anyone else that's listening tonight that's been intrigued with a lot of, you know, your anecdotes from your life, really it's very worthwhile watching. I certainly learned a lot and appreciated you even more from doing that oral history. I appreciate you taking the time to do that.
And I thank you for saying that. I had forgotten about that. You're right. I remember doing that here in my living room two or three years ago, I think. Right.
It is. It's been a few years, but it's still quite current, and you really cover a lot. There's so many things I could ask you, but I guess one of the things you've had such an impressive career, and, you know, through the 50s and 60s and obviously, you know, film The Titanic, and then, you know, obviously doing Young and the Restless. And I'm just curious, it's just maybe, you know, we don't see quite as much of actors doing episodic television as we did, I guess, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
But I'm wondering if maybe, because you did a lot of that,
right.
Are there elements of that have helped you in doing a ongoing daytime serial like Young and the Restless?
Well, that's a good question. I tell you, I mean, I guest starred on probably more episodic television than almost any other actor. And when you look at my IMDb, I think it's over 100. And what I learned from that is that I didn't want to do it anymore. And because, I tell you why, it's you inevitably played the bad guy on, be it Hawaii 5-0, FBI, Banachek, Kojak, I mean, all these television series they had. And I got sick and tired of playing the bad guy. It was too dehumanizing after a while. And So when the offer came to play the part that I'm playing now, I asked an old friend of mine who was a very good tennis player, Dabney Coleman, who's a wonderful actor, and I said, "What do you think?" He says, "Do it, you'll love it." And he had done some soap before, I forget which one. I didn't even know what a soap was. And I must say, the fact that I was, what all those guest starring episodes taught me is that I was burnt out. I didn't want to do it anymore. I wanted to do something that showed a greater complexity in a man than just either being good or bad. And on top of that, I found that a lot of the guys who played good guys in television series or whatever were often the biggest assholes around. Excuse me for saying so. Mm-hmm. And the bad guys were often the very nice guys. And I thought there's something so skewed about this picture of good and bad. Because in reality, we are capable of all kinds of things. And so, after first not liking Wynar at all for the first year, my wife and I had a long talk, and then she said, "Why don't you, try to make the best with what there is?" And I did, and then I talked to Bill Bell, the creator, and I said, "I need to do something that explains why Victor Newman is the bad guy he is." And he gave me this wonderful storyline. I never forgot it. In fact, yesterday I had a scene with Melody Thomas-Scott, Nikki. And I said, "Remember?" I said, we did the Christmas show. And I said, "Remember so many years ago? My God, now about 30 years ago,